From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Alan Young. Back in 2008, Esteban Nunez, the son of former Democratic Assembly Speaker Fabian Nunez, was involved in a knife fight that injured two men and claimed the life of a third. Esteban was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and two counts of assault with a deadly weapon in a case that gained national attention. In 2010, he entered Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California, to begin a 16-year prison sentence. However, on the governor's final night in office, then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger commuted Esteban's sentence as a favor to Esteban's father, Fabian. Esteban was released in 2016, having served less than 6 years. Esteban Nunez is now an advocate for the rights of people behind bars. He is also a senior vice president at Actum, a lobbying firm co-founded by his father. Esteban joins us today with Yannick Ortega, a substance use inpatient director, to discuss Proposition 6, a measure that would end mandatory prison labor in California. Despite having no formal opposition, Prop 6 has been struggling in the polls. Esteban, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yannick, we're happy to have you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Esteban, your story of incarceration and commutation has been told many times by many people. What have others missed when they write your story? Or I'd like to know, what feature of your experience do you think is important to highlight?
You know, for me, when I went into the prison system, I wanted to really take accountability for my actions. I wanted to better understand what influenced my criminal behaviors and why I hurt the people I love the most and the community at large. You know, I worked really hard and doing a lot of introspective works to really try to figure out what kind of traumas had influenced those behaviors. And it really forced me to deal and confront those traumas and to process them in a way that allowed me to be the person who I am today. You know, I think oftentimes we put people in the criminal justice system and think that, you know, they're just going to heal themselves, and that's just not how it works. There's a saying that hurt people and healed people heal people. I also had a lot of advocates, you know, obviously advocating for me on my behalf while I was in the carceral system. And I thought, you know, I had to pay it forward and be advocates for those who didn't have advocates for them. And that's what I've done with my life since then, is try to ensure people have a support system when they come home, but also have advocates for them because, you know, they're still human beings.
Can you tell me about the process of your rehabilitation?
Yeah, when I went in, I spent 3.5 months in solitary confinement. It was a culture shock for me, but it forced me to deal with my childhood traumas as a kid. And when I was 6 years old, I was molested by my cousin in Mexico. It's something that I probably would have taken to the grave had I not been confronted with the circumstances that I was. But, you know, when I left solitary, I really wanted to find opportunities to be able to process that trauma. Forced labor in prison really inhibited those opportunities for me. It became a roadblock, a barrier, if you will. And I thought, you know, what a shame. Like, the whole point of incarceration is to really be able to ensure you're coming home better positioned to be a successful member of society. But that just wasn't the circumstances when I was there, and still aren't today.
So what was that work program, and how did it impede the personal work that you wanted to do?
So when you have a work assignment, it takes precedent over anything, college coursework, over rehabilitative programming like Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, my crime involved alcohol, so I wanted to take part in Alcoholics Anonymous, but my work schedule conflicted with that. And I was working in the kitchen at the time, you know, and it took me years to really navigate the system inside to be able to find a work assignment, which was still in the kitchen, but had different hours that allowed me the opportunity to go to school, see a proctor for a college program, and then also take part in programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and Victims Offender programs, which were incredibly enlightening to me to be able to hear from a victim of homicide and hear, you know, just the riveting impacts of crimes such as my own.
And after nearly 6 years, you were released after a commutation. It was a controversial commutation. How do you reflect today on the circumstances around that?
You know, everything I do, I try to do it in a way that would make amends for the harm that I caused. You know, when I came home, I was going into juvenile halls, trying to mentor youth, trying to help them understand the depth of their actions. And to this day, you know, I still work on a lot of criminal justice reform, but not in the sense that all the reforms that I work on ensure accountability, but also ensure that we're positioning California to accept people for second chances, because, you know, we're not, I mean, at least for myself, I'm not the person who I was when I was a child. That action did not define me as an individual. It was a horrible decision, and I try to make up for it every day, but it doesn't define me as a person.
You've clearly done a lot of work. Does your story kind of follow the arc of rehabilitation that you found in many others?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an anomaly by any means. I'm just an example of a product of support and second chances. You know, I think we all coming home have a lot of shame for the actions that we took. I know I carry a lot of shame for it, but I do believe in redemption and second chances. And, I'm an example of it, but I'm not the only example. You know, Yannick is, of course, a phenomenal representation of that as well. And so are a lot of members of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, you know, which is an organization based in Los Angeles, also here in Sacramento, and also Sister Warriors, which is a female ran organization that represents a lot of formerly and currently incarcerated women.
We're going to pivot to Yannick and to Prop 6. Before that, I do want to ask, because you did go to work in state politics, which was such an interesting move. I mean, imagine you walk into the Capitol and there are some family connections, but also a lot of judgment. I mean, for all places to go, a place where, I mean, so many people know your story without knowing you. What's that like?
It was nerve-wracking at first. There was definitely a lot of animosity towards me. I would have to continuously, and I still tell myself, you know, I'm not here for me. Every time I walk into the Capitol, you know, it's for me, it's important to represent the people that I left behind. There's a lot of good people that I left behind, and, you know, just don't have anybody advocating on their behalf. And so, especially when one of the programs I would go into mentor youth was Pine Grove, which was a fire camp for youthful offenders. And you know, there was just no pathways for them coming home into gainful employment. And for me, I felt, you know, what a shame that we've taught these young people a craft that really exemplifies restorative justice. I mean, they're going out, putting their lives on the line to preserve communities. And yet we have no pathways for them to come home and get gainful employment. And so one of the pieces of legislation I worked on was to ensure that there was expungement opportunities for those individuals.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Esteban Nunez, a once incarcerated advocate for prisoners' rights, and his colleague, Yannick Ortega, about Proposition 6 to put an end to forced prison labor. Yannick, thank you for joining us. I'd love it if you told our listeners a bit about your experience in incarceration and also the topic that brings us in today, mandatory labor.
Good morning. So I was incarcerated. I had a 16-to-life sentence for second-degree murder. And throughout that time of my incarceration, I struggled with, you know, finding employment in there that would benefit me as an individual to grow as in education. I had a lot of anger within myself. Things that I experienced in my childhood contributed to that. And so throughout my time there, I did a lot of time in solitary confinement. But over time, throughout that 16 years or the 20 years that I did, I worked in different areas of the institution. I was called a supporter, which is like a janitor. And then I also worked yard crew, and I worked in central kitchen. It wasn't until, you know, later on in my time, I worked at the Prison Industry Authority, which is PIA, and we make clothes and flags. But it was not something that was initially offered to me because of my sentence. And then I started to advocate for myself because I felt strongly that, I didn't want to die in prison without an education or without change without being a better person or like healing from my trauma. And so I started to advocate with my case manager or my counselor at the time, letting her know that I wanted to participate in different programs, that I wanted to, you know, take anger management classes, criminal thinking classes. And about a year into advocating for myself, I was able to participate in the offender mentor certification program, which allowed me to be a substance abuse counselor, a certified substance abuse counselor in the institution. And with being able to do that, because prior working in the other parts of the institution, my work tickets wouldn't allow me to participate in self-help groups on the main yard. It wouldn't allow me to take the classes that I felt like would be beneficial to healing and growth as an individual, regardless of how much time I had. And so I started the program, and it allowed me to participate in those groups. And I found healing, and I found remorse and compassion and understanding for other people, just having a respect for the space of other people. As a lifer, you didn't get credits for, you know, participating in those classes, but it didn't matter to me. As long as I got to learn more about myself and allowing more rehabilitation in prison, it really does, you know, foster real change. It does allow us to see ourselves in a different perspective and to gain confidence within ourselves as individuals, and not just as an inmate or a person that committed a crime.
And what is your view on mandatory prison labor?
My view on it is that I feel like it should be an option for a person if they want to work. You know, Prop 6 doesn't stop you from working, but I believe that they should have an option to be able to go to a self-help group to learn about themselves, because the sentence itself is a sentence. You shouldn't be forced to work in an environment where you're supposed to be rehabilitating. And if you want to take the opportunity to heal, a work schedule should not stop you from doing that, because even in society, we are able to go to work, but we also have the opportunity to go to therapy and do things that make us feel better and to help us grow as individuals. And I think that the change starts in the institutions. It doesn't start when a person gets out of the institution. And if we want people to come back into society better than when they went in, then we need to, you know, give them the option of being able to participate in something that will allow them to prosper as an individual instead of picking up more toxic traits.
Thank you. Esteban, your campaign has argued that involuntary servitude is slavery. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's currently an exception to slavery, and it's in our Constitution as an exception to slavery.
So some may disagree. As you know, the U.S. version of slavery involved total control over a person's life and the lives of their children. Supporters of prison labor argue that it's part of the punishment and rehabilitation system. I've seen arguments that it fosters responsibility and opportunity to learn skills. Can you give us a little history on prison labor and explain why you believe that the mandatory labor is in fact slavery?
So when our Constitution, within our Constitution, it reads slavery is prohibited except for involuntary servitude. So involuntary servitude is an exception to slavery. I would argue that, our Constitution should embody our principles as a state and our principles as a nation. There are other states in 2022, like Alabama, Oregon, Tennessee, and Vermont, that voted to abolish the remnants of slavery from their constitution. And I think that California normally is ahead of these things, but we're falling behind. And, you know, when slavery was abolished, involuntary servitude became the practice. So you had states like Alabama and Tennessee that were forcing people into prison, charging them crimes for just being black, for walking across the street, and putting them in prison to have them continue using their labor. And involuntary servitude has such been the practice. And so it behooves us as a state to ensure that we are eliminating all the remnants of slavery from our Constitution. I don't think forced labor is part of part of taking accountability. I think when you're able to really take accountability, it means really understanding the depth of your decisions, your criminal behavior, and processing that and healing from that and changing your life around. I think the more people that are able to really understand that rehabilitation allows folks to deal with the underlying condition of what brought them into prison in the first place, the better society is going to be as a whole. Our recidivism rates have remained pretty stagnant for the past number of decades. And so why is that? It's because forced labor really has prohibited people from being able to curb recidivism. And so if we're able to remove forced labor and allow folks to focus on rehabilitation, recidivism rates are going to go down, which means it will also save taxpayer money because it costs $134,000 a year to incarcerate one person.
So how many hours is a person typically working in a forced labor scenario versus how much time do you think they have for these types of rehabilitative programs?
You're working at least 6 to 8 hours a day, but I think it's just the funky schedules. And you're also at the mercy of the people who are coming in to provide the rehabilitative programming. You know, it's not really whenever you're available. It's when the proctor or the person facilitating the group is available. And so if your schedule conflicts with that, you're not able to take part in it. There's even been instances where you've gotten permission from your supervisor to be able to take part in things like visiting with family. But because your schedule just conflicts with that, you're denied those visits or those opportunities. And visiting with family, by the way, has proven to reduce recidivism by like 8 to 16%. So it's counterproductive and intuitive for us as a state when we're spending $134,000 a year to incarcerate somebody.
So what's the consequence of refusing to work or, as you mentioned, missing a shift for another reason, like visiting family?
The consequences range, but, you know, it can add time to your sentence. You can go into confined to quarters, which essentially is solitary confinement. You lose access to your phone calls to be able to call your family. They limit how much you can go to the canteen and store. And then you're not able to take part in any kind of educational rehabilitative programming whatsoever.
And so what kind of jobs are we talking about in forced labor?
We're talking about kitchen jobs, porter jobs, yard crew jobs, jobs that essentially are used to maintain the everyday practices of the facilities.
And so who would do that work if this measure were to succeed, and how much would they get paid?
It would still be the people incarcerated. I mean, there's a lot of people inside that want to work, and I wanted to work in the kitchen because you have access to more food than the regular population. And so there are incentives currently in place. You know, these other states that have passed similar propositions have not seen or have not needed to increase the wages or go to outside vendors to fulfill those positions. I mean, they still are being filled by people that are incarcerated. You're allowing people the autonomy to make that decision. I mean, we have an ambassador who wanted to take part in anger management, had somebody who was willing to take his position in the kitchen, which would allow him to do so, and the prison still denied it. And so this is really just about allowing folks the autonomy to be able to prioritize their own program.
I'll give the final question to Yannick. Yannick, so we're talking about Proposition 6, which would stop mandatory prison labor among incarcerated people. In an October survey from the Public Policy Institute of California, 56% of people were opposed to Prop 6. Why do you think that is, and what do people need to know about this measure?
I think that's because people have a lack of knowledge of what is actually happening in the institutions and what it really consists of for a person that is incarcerated to be working in that environment, and what they're lacking in that environment. And I think that what's important for people to know is that regardless of whatever our perception is of what's happening in the institutions, people are going to be released. And do you want the person that's being released to be somebody that is going to be your neighbor, your employee, your you know, somebody that's around your kids, picking up their kids at school? Do you want that person to be a person that you feel is safe? Or do you want a person that is going to come back out with more negative behaviors than they had when they went in? Proposition 6 will allow a person to have the advantage of healing and identifying, getting insight and awareness into their behaviors and into their characteristics and character defects and coming out a more productive citizen of society and willing to respect the space of other people. And so when we pass this, we allow people to change the behaviors and to come back out and to be, you know, successful. I am a prime example of that. I went in angry and with a lot of issues, and I took classes and I worked on myself and I got an education, and now I am a director of an inpatient facility with 19 employees under me. And it's because I was allowed the education and I was allowed to take the time to work on myself and be an example of rehabilitation.
That's great. Yannick, we happy for your personal story, and thank you for coming on and telling our listeners about Proposition 6.
Thank you.
Esteban, thanks again for sharing your personal story and for raising awareness about what it's like on the inside and this measure that you care about.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Esteban Nunez and Yannick Ortega are with the Yes on Proposition 6 campaign, a measure that would end mandatory prison labor. Coming up next, CAP Radio's own Shristi Prabha is here with Sean and Poonam Dhaliwal from Taj Supermarket to talk about celebrating Diwali. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Alan Young.